Join me on May 13th to the 21st on our Paraguay Investors Tour. Earlier this year, I unveiled an exciting real estate project in Paraguay that sold out in one day. Now, you can come down to Paraguay side by side with me to learn about what everyone was so excited about and even see new exciting projects you can participate in. We will also examine residency, banking, safety, and many other important aspects of a proper Plan B. Join us for this luxury tour to Paraguay on May 13th to the 21st, and tickets include all food, alcohol, transport, activities, hotel stay, and domestic flights. For more information, please email Susan James from my team at trips@expatmoney.com or visit our tours page at expatmoney.com. Email trips@expatmoney.com for more information. All Expat Money subscribers are welcome to join me for this trip. Seats are filling up fast. Email trips@expatmoney.com.
We all dream of seeing the world, but the realities of living somewhere outside your place of birth can be daunting, to say the least. Welcome to the Expat Money Show, helping you make the most out of your overseas career through conversations with successful expats on investing, entrepreneurship, self-improvement, and continual education, all while sharpening your financial acumen. Now please welcome your host, with over 20 years of overseas experience, Mikkel Thorup.
Hey everyone, Mikkel here. Okay, before we jump into today's episode, I want to remind you that if you go to expatmoneyshow.com, you're going to be able to download our special report. It's called 19 International Strategies to Grow and Protect Your Wealth Abroad. It has been a project of mine I have been working on for maybe 4 years now, and I constantly update this with the newest and best strategies. Now, it's really different than a lot of other special reports or books out there because this one is really short, and it is short on purpose. What I want to do is kind of highlight to you the best of the best strategies that are out there in the world, and then where you can go for additional information or how you can get involved in these things. So instead of writing a 500-page special report on this, which probably chances are no one is going to read it, this is really highly condensed information. I've actually put it in an infographic. It's an infographic special report. It has helped thousands upon thousands of people really get a grasp of being an expat and what type of things are out there to protect your assets, professionals that you should be working with, investments, real estate, these types of things. So it's called 19 International Strategies to Grow and Protect Your Wealth Abroad. You can pick it up at expatmoneyshow.com. You'll see it. It's on the very first page at the very top. All you need to do is put in your name and email address. You're going to get a chance to actually join my private email list, EMS Pulse. And there's just so much great things that are shared on there. It's completely free. There's no funnel. There's no trick to this. There's no credit card needed, anything like that. It's just a good resource for you, my listener, who I love and adore. And I want to do right by you guys. So go to expatmoneyshow.com, pick this up. Let me know what you think. I'll talk to you soon. Enjoy today's episode. Hey everyone. Okay, we are going to be doing part two of my sailing mini series. This is an awesome conversation with Brady Troutman. Oh my God. Like, I think that I've done a lot of crazy, cool, interesting, wild stuff in my life. Brady has done a lot. He makes me envious. He makes me go, wow, I've not done anything. This is an amazing individual. His YouTube channel has something like 670,000 subscribers, and they've documented years of travel. So I'm not going to spoil the surprise because I do want you to listen to this episode, but this is part two in our mini series on sailing. So if you haven't heard part one, then you might want to go back and check out episode 120 with Nick and Teresa. It is a really, really good interview, and I think you're going to find it really interesting. Okay, enjoy today's show, and make sure you also check us next week for episode 122 with Jim and Judy Brown. That's going to be an awesome one too. Okay, let's jump in. Welcome. My name is Mikkel Thorup, and this is the Expat Money Show. Today's guest is an entrepreneur, filmmaker, and the co-founder of the YouTube channel SV Delos. Originally from Florida, he studied environmental engineering before making the transition to full-time sailing. His skills in marketing, video editing, and qualifications as a dive master, dive instructor, and rescue diver have played a huge part in keeping Delos in the top echelons of the YouTube sailing channels, all the while inspiring others to follow their dreams. Please welcome to the show, Brady Trautman. Brady, how are you?
I'm good, man. How are you today?
Doing really well. I'm really excited for today's conversation. I've checked out your YouTube channel. Man, you have done some incredible stuff in your life. So I guess straight off the bat, like, how did you get into sailing? How did you decide that this is what you wanted to do? And man, what's your backstory?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show, man. It's always good to talk to people like this and have conversations and kind of spread the word about sailing and travel in general. So it's really cool to be here and chat about it. So how I got into sailing, it was kind of like a snowball effect of the universe just kind of throwing things at me. It was never a decision that I was like, you know, from the time I was three, I meet a lot of people that knew what they wanted to do. And it was definitely not me at all. I didn't grow up sailing. Our parents, me and my brother, the one who I started the YouTube channel with, we didn't grow up sailing. Our parents didn't grow up sailing. Our dad gets seasick. So it's definitely not something that's in our blood. Later on in life, when I was going to college, I got into scuba diving and I became a dive instructor down in the Florida Keys. And I was working for the Boy Scouts of America. So basically they didn't pay you very much, but they would pay you in experiences and certifications. So they put me all the way up through my dive instructor and they were able to give me my captain's license to operate like the little dive boats and take the 12, 13 year old kids out diving. And that's kind of when I really, really fell in love with the ocean and especially diving. And I don't know, I just always saw it as like the biggest kind of highway in the world, like the best way to go and travel and see the planet. And at the same time, my older brother, Brian, was working in Seattle and he got into sailing. He started off with like a 22-foot Catalina and he's 10 years older than me. So at the time I was 20 and he was 30, like, you know, he'd been working for his company for 10 years or whatever and was ready to get the hell out. And him and his partner found a boat. It was a 53-foot Amel Super Marimu. So like a big step up from the boat that they learned on. And they decided to sell everything and sail down the coast to Mexico. And they gave me a call and was like, hey, dude, you want to come and help us cross from Mexico to French Polynesia? And yeah, I literally took out all my student loans I could, signed up for all the classes, took out the student loans, then dropped all the classes and took the money and left.
That's so, one way to do it. Okay, so let's track the journey a little bit, I guess, because I mean, I there's so many things I want to talk to you about, but let's start with the journey. Okay, so the first thing you did was sail across the Pacific.
That's that was our first big passage.
Okay, so correct me if I'm wrong or not, but I mean, that's kind of like a big step, isn't it? Like, don't usually people putter around in like like calm waters, maybe in the Caribbean for a couple of years or something first?
Yeah, it is. I mean, my brother and his partner had sailed up in Seattle for about a year, just like kind of around the area, leaving for a day or two and then coming back to the marina. But for me specifically down in the Keys, I did like some day sailing trips, one or two overnight trips, but nothing big. So yeah, for all of us, this was a very, very big step. And I think back, I mean, it was 2010 when we did this. So like Instagram wasn't around, like you didn't really rely on the internet as much for things. Whereas now I think you do so much research, you kind of scare yourself away from making a trip like that without knowing what the hell you're doing. But back then it was just like, oh yeah, the wind blows in that direction. And kind of, we just get enough food and water and just go. And eventually we'll hit Tahiti or something. That was kind of the thought process behind it.
Totally understand. Because I mean, I hitchhiked through Central and South America for 18 months in 2002, 2003, something like 2003, 2004, I think it was. And I mean, we had no internet. There was no research. It was like, I'm going south.
That's it. I got a big red backpack. I'm going south. I got a thumb. I'm going to put that out and I'm just going to go south. That was about as far as I
relied. Relied on people that had the experience before you, or
exactly. You meet people on the road and stuff like that. Maybe you guys, I don't know. Do you meet other people on the open ocean? Do you meet people in port or something and get advice from them, or how does that work?
Definitely. I mean, still some of the friends that we met in Mexico for that crossing in 2010, we're still friends with, like 10 years later.
Wow.
And that's like amazing. some of them gone on to make films and create businesses, and a lot of them are still sailing with their families. And yeah, it's really cool.
So that's an interesting point. You met these people 10 years ago and they're still continuing on sailing. So this is not like a phase or a fad. People do it for 6 months and then they'll get bored of it or something and then they go do something else.
Yeah, some people. I mean, I think we met a lot of people that had like an 18th month goal where they're like, okay, I'm taking a sabbatical from work. I saved up enough money. I'm going to rent the house out, buy the boat, sail around the world for 18 months, 2 years, whatever, and then come back, sell the boat and go back to normal life. So there is a lot of people that do that as well. And we met them along the way. They were always going really fast past us. And they're like, oh, I wish we could stay, but we have to go. So we always stayed in the place for a couple months and they would stay for a week or two. But then, yeah, there's the other side of people that the family that I'm talking about, Totem, they raised three children on board. And one of the kids has gone off to college and the other two girls live on board still. And they're down in Mexico again. They've completed their circumnavigation. They're getting ready to cross the Pacific again.
Wow. So let's talk about the journey across the Pacific. How long does something like that take? Or maybe a better question is, how long did it take you guys to do?
So it took us, we were at sea for, I think it was 19 days on that trip. So it was a solid passage. I mean, it's one of the biggest passages you can do in the world, being the furthest from land as possible. And we left Puerto Vallarta in Mexico March or early April of 2010. And yeah, made it to the Marquesas, which is, I think the total distance is about 3,200 miles. I could be saying that wrong. It's been a while since I've looked at the distance. For sure. But yeah, man. And then you're in the trade winds. There's a reason why Jimmy Buffett and all these guys wrote songs about sailing in the South Pacific. It's just like beautiful, calm conditions all the time, constant winds. And that passage was definitely transformative for me, because I took a break from college to do this and I was planning on going back 3 months later. And during that passage, something just kind of clicked where I was like, this is kind of what I need to do. And this is where I'm supposed to be. And, you know, the first 3 days you're like reading and listening to audiobooks or watching movies that you downloaded on the hard drive. And then you get super bored and you stare at the ocean for 4 or 5 hours at a time. And then all of a sudden, like all that shit just goes away. And you're like, days just like pass by like this. And before you know it, you're like, holy shit, we've been out here 2 weeks. And it just doesn't matter. Like the whole world just melts away. And the only thing you're worried about is catching fish and eating and getting water.
See, I would like that. My days start at about 7:30 in the morning. I basically wake up, reach over, grab my phone and start working immediately. And I finish at around 12:30 at night. And I mean, it seems six and a half days a week is like this. I mean, maybe I'll take a half a day on Sunday or something, the mornings on Sunday, and play with my kid. But I mean, I've just gotten so caught up in work stuff and building the business. I mean, just staring at the ocean for 5 hours actually sounds like a treat to me. Like, I think that would do me very well for my mental health.
We call it Seahab.
Seahab. What is Seahab? Explain.
It's like rehab, but for the sea. And it's not necessarily for alcohol or joy. It's just kind of like for mental well-being. It kind of, you go on a long passage and you just kind of get back in touch with everything that's, you kind of forget when you're working 15-hour days.
Yeah, that sounds...
are you happy doing what you're doing? Are you happy working that much?
Yeah, I mean, I'm building my business. I'm building my own brand and everything like that. Yeah. So, and I'm my own boss. So I do this to myself, but I have a family. And, you know, I remember when I met my wife, one of the things that she told me that she loves about me is I'm so responsible. I'm such a good father and I put in so much time and effort and I put my family first all these times. So I always try to remember, like, there's lots of times I'm like, I'm so tired. I don't want to do this. I mean, I want to sit around and read a book or something, but I'm like, no, I got responsibilities. I got followers. I've got clients. I've got people who need stuff done and people are counting on me. So therefore I'm going to suck it up. That's my job and I'm going to do it. Driven. That's exactly. Like, you know, I'm not a chauvinist or anything like that, but I do think that it's a man's responsibility to provide for his family. And I want to make sure that my wife and my child can always count on me. That is really, really important to me. But anyways, I want to get back to the South Pacific. So you sailed across the ocean. What were the countries you hit in the South Pacific?
Mm-hmm. So the first place we came into was, it's called French Polynesia, which is kind of the Society Islands, which is where Tahiti is, and people know that very well, Bora Bora. There's also a group of islands called the Tuamotus, which are like very small atolls with like super crystal clear blue water on the inside, and then it drops on the outsides. And then the Marquesas Islands are the furthest east of the French Polynesia group. And those are like straight out of Jurassic Park, just like huge volcanic peaks, a lot like Hawaii, super untouched and very like Polynesian culture. It's really special to like leave Mexico, be at sea for 3 weeks and show up, and it's like straight up Polynesian culture like you've never seen before. So that's kind of the furthest east of the South Pacific. And then as you work your way west, the next stop was Tonga, Niue, the Cook Islands, and then Fiji. And by this point, when we got to Fiji, we were gone from Mexico for about 6 or 7 months. And the cyclone season was starting. So the biggest thing about sailing is around the world like that is it's always based on the seasons. Like the weather controls everything, where you go, what time you go, where you anchor. So when the cyclone season starts to kick in the South Pacific, you want to be way out of the way down in New Zealand, just as if you don't want to be in the Caribbean during hurricane season, you want to be out of the way.
So is that like a migration of boats? Like, do you see the same people at the yacht club in different countries as time goes by? Because everyone kind of follows the same rough route, or do you see people and then never see them again and it's always new people?
You know, it's both. Like I said, some people are moving at a faster pace, so people will blast past you, but you often find these groups of boats and like we call them buddy boating or whatever, but there's these little communities that join together and you just become friends. And it happens a lot with kid boats. So like if there's two families on separate boats and they have kids of similar ages, they'll just stay together for like months or years and just sail to the same islands and have the kids learn together and play together.
And when you say together, do you mean like you can still see the other boat while you're sailing, or it's like, I'll meet you in Tahiti in 2 weeks and we'll catch up then?
Both, really.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
I mean, I think when people first start out and they want a buddy boat, they want to be within eyesight range, just for safety's sake. But once you start sailing, you're like, we're going to leave tonight. Okay, we'll leave tomorrow. We'll see you in Tahiti, or we'll see you in a week in Fiji or whatever it is. But yeah, there's definitely a huge migration of boats every year from Mexico to, you know, either New Zealand or Australia. And they're all doing the same thing. It's called the Coconut Run. You go across the South Pacific, or the Barefoot Run, you know, cause you don't ever wear shoes.
Yeah.
And you end up 9 months later in New Zealand escaping the cyclones.
Amazing. So did you do much diving when you were in the South Pacific? I lived in the South Pacific for 4 years and just dove all through Tonga and Vanuatu and Fiji and Australia and New Zealand and all over the place there. And it was spectacular.
Yeah, that was a huge thing for me because I was a dive instructor in the Keys before this trip. And like, I remember, I mean, the dive shop next to us in the Keys, I would go through the magazines and I'd see like people diving in Bora Bora and all this. And it was like, holy shit, like I have a chance to go to the places I've been looking at in magazines. So it was huge. Yeah, we put a compressor on Delos so we could fill
it. You had your own compressor on the boat?
Yeah. We had six dive tanks and our own compressor.
I was already jealous of you, Brady. Now I'm like super.
Yeah, man, we would dive. I mean, that was our thing. Is like, you know, you could, some people travel the world by sailboat and they surf or they go on hikes or whatever. They're foodies and they want to just experience the best of the food culture. Our thing was scuba diving for sure. We would go to
the most remote place. So you had all your own gear, you had your own tanks, you had your own compressors. So you were like self-sufficient for diving.
Yeah. Fully self-sufficient. Yep. Solar panels, everything just ready to go.
That's amazing. Because all of my dive trips, like I've dove, certainly not as much as you have, but I've dove, you know, 130, 140 times in 15, 20 different countries. But I go on dive holidays. I fly to a country. I dive my heart out for 7 days straight, take a couple days chilling out, and then fly back and would go to work or something like that. That'd be my vacation. But yeah, the dream is to be able to dive anytime. So let me ask you, when you do have that option of diving anytime, do you take advantage of it, or does it kind of get like, oh, I don't feel like it. I've done this before. I've seen it before.
Yeah, it does get like that a while. Like, you do get a little bit jaded. I don't know, even after 10 years, we were still super in love with diving just as much as when we started, and for different reasons, especially when you get into underwater photography and videography, you'll be like, oh, this dive, I'm going to focus on the smallest things possible. And then, you know, maybe you'll spend 2 days going out of your way because you heard there's a chance of seeing a whale shark or manta rays somewhere. So you kind of have these goals that kind of keep it very fulfilling. One thing that's really special about diving so much is you don't have to do long dives. So, like, you know, when you're on vacation, and sometimes when we go with companies, they're like, okay, this dive's going to be an hour and 15 minutes long. And you're like, what the fuck? Yeah. Like, or, you know, or like when we dive off Delos, you know, sometimes we do 20, 30 minute dives because it just doesn't matter. Like, if there's nothing there, we get bored or it gets cold, you just get out because you can do it again at any point.
Yeah. Because so you're not doing like, okay, you got two tanks for the day and you want to get every last second out of those two tanks, and then that's it. I mean,
no, luckily we didn't really dive like that. So
crazy.
Very grateful.
So Cyclone Susan is coming in and you're leaving the South Pacific. I want to do the around the world. Like, what happened next? Where'd you go next?
Well, I was supposed to fly back and finish college at that point. And I didn't. I just decided I called my dad who had my car, and I told him to sell it or take it over. And I was just like, this is what I want to do. And I think college for me was all about figuring out what I didn't want to do and kind of just, you know, sticking to the norm of like, well, I'm supposed to get a degree. I'm supposed to do this. I kind of enjoy this, but nothing ever felt right until I was actually sailing and traveling. And that's when I feel like I could invest 100% of my time and my energy and my student loans into what I actually wanted to learn. And that was just about the world, basically, and see where it took me. But it only lasted so long. So when we got to New Zealand, we were dead broke. Like, we had no money left in savings. The boat wasn't paid off. It was mortgaged just like a house. So we had a boat payment. So we went off and looked for jobs, and we did random work. My brother worked. He's an electrical engineer. That's what he majored in. So he helped out some bigger yachts with electrical systems on the boats. I got day work, like cleaning boats, and I ended up managing a Mexican restaurant in New Zealand called Mexicali Fresh.
So was this all under the table type of work, or did you guys end up getting a visa? Or
actually, the day work stuff was cash work under the table, but because I was under 30, New Zealand and Australia at that time, and they may still have it, had an under 30 traveler's visa where you could get a year working visa if you were under 30 years old. So that's what I got. And I was legally working and being taxed. And
I did the same ones. I did 1 year in New Zealand, and then I did a year in Australia, and then I did a bridging visa, and then I got a sponsorship, and I did a 457 skilled migrant worker. And then I was in Australia for 3 years. And those are great programs. I mean, I think they still do them. I hope so. I'm certainly more than 30 years old now, but I hope they still do them. They're really good opportunities for people in their 20s.
They're so great. I met so many incredible people that, they just traveled to New Zealand and be like, I'm going to work for a year before, in between going from high school to college. And I feel like culturally, a lot of other places in the world do that a lot better than America does, like the gap year and stuff. And I was like, holy shit, like, this exists. Why isn't this like this back home? Right after high school, you go straight to college and you better figure out what you want to do.
Yeah. And it's not even talked about in the school. It's not even like presented as an option to take a gap year or to go out there and see the world. I mean,
whereas in these countries, it's almost required. Yeah. It's like, you have a year, go. So yeah, it was really special, and it made us, we were able to save enough money. I mean, we didn't save that much, but we were able to save enough to sail out of New Zealand. We lived in New Zealand for about 8 or 9 months. And then, we took a break. We know the boat was at the dock, so we're not constantly moving. It's kind of like an apartment at that point, a small apartment. And then we left again, and we set sail for Fiji again. And then we went to the Solomon Islands, Vanuatu first, and then the Solomon Islands.
Did you dive the USS President Coolidge?
I did, yeah. We dove the Coolidge for like a week straight.
Yeah, me too. That thing is unbelievable. I love the wreck diving. Yeah, I dove the wreck. I was there, I think it was there about 10 days, and dove 2-3 times a day for 7 days straight. I must have done 20 dives on that one wreck and just never got bored.
Did you end up doing the gauntlet where they like take you into the stern? Because you know it's sitting on,
yeah, because it's on its side and it's like, yeah, on an angle. Yeah.
Like by the end, this our dive guide, and I'll never do this again. It's even embarrassing to say that we did this because it's super dangerous, but he took us down to the sand, which was at 221 feet.
Yeah, it's just 63 meters. Yeah, it's crazy.
We got 70. Yeah, and we touched sand, so narked, like just completely out of it. And it was like, follow me through the ship. And we did the entire ship out. I was like, you know, halfway running out of air. And it was just like one of those situations where you're like, that was so stupid. I'm glad I did it, but I'm never going that deep again.
Air. Not encouraging others to do it.
No,
I didn't do that one. Did a ton of dives on it. Didn't make it quite down to the deepest part. But yeah, that was a good dive. So, okay. I'm curious. I mean, so up until this point, you've been working and saving and then sailing, working, sailing, saving, that type of thing. So what was the transition to, you know, I want to do this for a living. I want to, you know, go into YouTube, or I want to be a, I don't know, digital nomad. I don't even know when that name kicked in or became popular. Let's talk about that a little bit. We will just take a quick break. In a lot of the circles that I run in, the content creators are being deplatformed. People are being banned on Twitter, censored on Facebook, and YouTube channels are being demonetized, basically cutting off people's ability to reach their audience and share their message with the world. And it has gotten even worse than that. Entire companies are under siege. Servers are being shut down, and their products are being taken off of the App Store and Google Play. There is no question about it. There are some scary things going on right now. I want to make sure that I can continue to provide for you the best news and information from the offshore space every single week. That's why I want you to pause this episode right now and visit expatmoneyshow.com/protection to sign up for EMS Pulse, my weekly newsletter. In it, you will find personal insights from my travels and over 21 years of experience in the international space. We will be looking at foreign businesses, generating income online, asset protection, corporate structures, new visas for digital nomads, and a whole lot more. So I hope you will take me up on this opportunity and sign up for my newsletter to make sure that you can continue to receive the best from the offshore space now directly to your inbox. Go to expatmoneyshow.com/protection. Okay, let's jump back into the episode.
For sure. So when we first left, we were writing blogs and taking pictures just to share stories with family and friends. And because, I mean, back then there wasn't many young people doing what we were doing. Like every boat we saw was, you know, a retired couple or a family that was, you know, either 40s or 50s and had just had kids. So, but like a group of younger 30, 20 year olds. And there was always, you know, four or five of us on the boat, just friends or whoever we met along the way, backpackers that would join us. It was a really unique circumstance. And even our blog was getting quite a bit of like, not a huge following, but people were reading it besides our parents, you know, and that's kind of a big deal back then. And, but still our family and friends were still like, I don't get it. Like, what the hell are you guys doing out there? Like you're living on a boat, you're traveling from place to place and the pictures and the stories are cool, but we just don't understand it. So then we bought a small camcorder and we just started filming daily life, small stuff. And we put it on YouTube because that's just what it was pretty new in the world. And we were like, oh, here's a link, and sent it to our family and friends so they could watch what we were doing instead of just pictures and blogs. And then other people just started watching and it just started kind of growing organically. And for the first year, I mean, we just did it completely for fun. Didn't even cross our minds that it could turn into a business or anything lucrative. It was just purely to share stories. And my brother and I would always just say, if this is something that we're doing so we can look back in 20 years and laugh at pretty much. Like that was it. That was why we did it. So, and then YouTube one day sent us a check to our mom's house for like, I don't know, $30, $28 or something.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell is this? And it was like for ad revenue because they were putting ads in our videos.
Yeah.
And it just like kind of clicked a little bit. We're like, holy shit, if we can make 30, I mean, that's a case of beer. Like if you can make that in a month, that's great.
Yeah.
So we just kept going. And then the channel was growing. And then one of our followers reached out and was like, hey, there's this new thing, Patreon, that started.
So what year? Let's pause for a second. What year did the YouTube channel start, and then what year did Patreon start? Like for you guys,
The YouTube channel, we started posting in like 2011, end of 2011.
So you're not only probably one of the largest or the largest YouTube sailing channels, but you were probably one of the first YouTube sailing channels as well.
Yeah. I don't think, I mean, there's a guy, Rick Moore, that had been putting random small clips up on YouTube in 2010. But I think as far as like storyline based, we were the first YouTube sailing channel. Yeah. And then it just, yeah. And now there's, I don't know, 12,000 of them, I think, something like that. But so the 2011 or so is when we started kind of releasing short videos on, and they, a lot of them were just pictures and music and stuff, just like montages. And then 2013, maybe to the end of 12. So like a year and a half later is when somebody was like, hey, there's this thing Patreon you guys should look into. And that's when we started our Patreon account. And then that just kind of started growing, and we just kept getting newer camera gear and better camera gear. And just at some point we were able to pay for the mortgage of the boat, like in probably around 2013 or 14. And that was huge. That was, you know, $1,500 or $2,000 a month. And that was just like, we still had to work, and we still had to like go off and do things that wasn't a full-time job making the videos, but it was just huge that it was cutting it out. And then we saw the scalability of it, and you could just see, like, if you just keep doing what you're doing, eventually more people watch, become patrons, and you don't have to work harder. You just kind of have to keep doing what you're doing and be consistent about it. So once we started releasing videos every Friday, and once you do things for so long, like I'm sure you know, you get really good at it. So like our editing skills got a lot better, our videography skills got better, and we kept reinvesting into newer and better cameras, and just trying different things and following different storylines. And yeah, then it just kind of grew to a point where we were like, we can actually turn this into a little bit more than just a lifestyle business and make a little bit of a career out of it.
Amazing. So break down for me, what were your, not roles and responsibilities, that makes it sound so boring, but I mean, what were the things that you were kind of doing? What were the things your brother was doing? What was the kind of things that his partner was doing? I mean, did you guys have a division here, or did everybody do everything, or was it really thought out at the beginning when you were making these videos and starting to grow?
Yeah, when we first started, I mean, everybody was doing everything. We were all filming, we were all editing. My brother, I mean, because the boat is his name, he's the captain of the boat. But it was never like a captain and crew situation. Like the way we all handled it was like, this was our boat, it was our home. So we all made decisions together. We all voted on where we wanted to go, what we wanted to do. A lot of the maintenance stuff we all split. So it was definitely a group effort in all aspects. Everybody did all the cooking. Like it was all huge group aspect of it.
And then, all right, so if you were with your sibling for so long, did you guys get along the whole time? I'm trying to think of like what me and my brother would be like. I mean, I had him traveling with me for years, and we did pretty good, but we also had like separate apartments, or I mean, at least separate bedrooms and things. But I think in a boat, I mean, that must get a little bit cramped, and maybe tempers flare, I don't know.
Yeah, that's a huge question, and we get that so often. It's just like, how can you live with your brother for so long, and aren't you guys, did you kill yourself along the way, or how do you not get in fights? And I don't know, I think for my brother and I, because we have a 10-year gap between us, we were just far enough apart where, and we had a lot of the same interests, so we got along super well. Like, I mean, there's definitely disagreements, and we get annoyed with each other, and at the end of the day we do have very different personalities, but I think they complemented each other, especially with building the channel and the business and stuff. So I don't know, man. It's we have a brother between us as well, so there's a middle brother, and we get along really well too. But I think it's just kind of the more I think about it, our kind of low-key personalities, where it's just like communication, and we don't want any drama, and it just kind of works
out. And you guys are mature enough to understand maybe it's not worthwhile to get that last word in or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
But okay, so you just threw another wrench into it. Okay, you have a brother who is aged between the pair of you. How is he not like super jealous that you guys, well, first of all, are spending so much time together. But second of all, I mean, sailing around the world, Like, he wasn't interested, yeah. or you guys just were like, ah, I'm not going to invite him. He's not cool enough. Like,
you
how
know,
did that
he
work?
Had, at that point when we left, I mean, he had already had his first kid and he had his own business, and he's, I think he's just not as like super adventurous wanting to go travel. I'm sure he'd love to do it, but it's not like, I have to go and see the world. I have to go travel. He's like, I'm super happy here with my kid and my wife and having the house and the car and all that stuff really does fulfill him.
Okay.
So yeah, he's just a little bit different of a brother than the other cool. two on the outsides are.
Has he been down to see you guys, been on vacation and sailed with you a little bit, or just really like no interest?
Yeah, no, he came down and sailed with us from the Keys up to Fort Lauderdale when we finally made it back to America. And he's been on the boat, you know, a handful of times since then and done little passages and stuff. And he loves it, definitely loves it for sure. But I just don't know if he has like that sailor's, I don't know what like the sailor, the rum running through the veins, you know?
Awesome. Okay, so let's go back here. So YouTube pays you a $30 check. You're like, this is sweet. I mean, there's something to this. 6 months, year later, whatever it was, Patreon. Someone says, okay, get a Patreon account. You know, I want to support you guys. I want to help. You guys should look into this. How did that scale? Did it stay at $30 for a while? Did it go to enough that like this was going to pay for things on its own? Or like, talk me through the financial side, I guess, of how you monetized, how you made money, how you continued to do this. Because in our story, we're still back 8 years ago or 7 years ago. I mean, if that was staying at $30, I'm sure there's no way you would have been able to continue the journey.
Yeah. Yeah, it grew very, very slow, but steady. Like there was that steady kind of slope that was growing. And it took from the time we did Patreon until the time like all expenses were paid for the boat, including like food, fuel, maintenance, mortgage, insurance, everything. Yeah, that didn't make it to that point until I would say 2016, 2017. So you're talking 4 or 5 years of constant hard 15-hour days, lots of work, filming, editing, fixing the boat, moving from country to country before it was able to cover the cost of the boat, which would be maybe like, you know, $5,000 a month, something like that. So it took a lot of time for it to get to that point. And then once it got to that point, we just kept pushing it and kept pushing it. And then of course it grew from there. And I mean, even to this day, we're not wealthy by any means, but we've been able to pay for the production as well. Work on different productions. Like I'm sure we're going to talk a little bit about our Svalbard expedition and our documentary we were able to make. And then also be able to save a little bit of money too. So
cool. So I think this is an important point because I think that a lot of people out there would listen to this and go, wow, I just go out, take some pictures and film my sailing and, you know, that's going to fund it. I mean, but you guys put a lot of work into this and not over a month, but I mean, over years
yeah.
to build this up to something substantial.
Definitely. And I get messages every day that's like, hey, I just bought a boat. I'm starting a YouTube channel about sailing and traveling. Like, what did you do? How do you suggest I make money? Like, I want to quit my job, and how do you suggest I make money doing it? I'm just like, make money a different way and sail for fun. Like that's, you know, it's hard advice, but the only reason we were successful is because we didn't see it as a way to turn it into a job. We loved what we were doing and we were authentic about it. We're like, if this never makes money, it's awesome. Like we love it. We can look back in 20 years and look at these videos. We're traveling the world. If it pays for a fraction of our traveling cost, awesome. And I think that's why it was successful, because a lot of people see the authenticity that you're not doing it just to make a product and make money and make clickbait nowadays and everything else that goes with creating YouTube videos. It didn't matter back then. It was just like, we're going to film whatever the hell we want, edit it however we want. And if people watch, they watch. If not, who cares? Because it made us smile. And that's what led to the success. So I think the advice that I give most people that ask me those questions is like, just do what you love and be authentic about it. That's the only way you're going to get anywhere in like the creative space of whether it's YouTube or podcast or writing a book or whatever it is. You just have to be yourself and that'll shine through and people will see that and grasp onto it. And then it'll start to grow and hopefully make money.
That makes sense. But I think that is really good advice, because I think that a lot of people just see this romantic dream and they just think that, I mean, it's so easy. Just take some videos, put it up, and I mean, suddenly I'm going to have thousands of followers. First of all, yeah. I think that the space and everything, every niche out there in YouTube is massively crowded at the moment. Like, I think whatever it is you want to do. So that's good advice.
That's another good point that you said too. I think it was timing too, because, you know, right now, if we were to go do the same thing, I don't even know if I'd start a YouTube channel. Like, I don't know if I'd be into filming it. It was because nobody was doing it that it felt super authentic, like you were doing something special for the first time. So yeah, timing is everything when it comes to this stuff as well.
Okay, so you leave New Zealand and you went off to Fiji, you went to a couple more South Pacific islands. You've got a little bit of money in your pocket. What did you do next? Did you go up to Asia? Did you turn around and go home? Where did you go?
Yep. So then we went to Australia and we stayed in Australia. I mean, we were still, this is 2012 still. So before we started being able to make any sort of money. So we were very broke. Like, if we were broke when we got to New Zealand, when we got to Australia, we were like in debt broke, like borrowing money, credit cards, all kinds of stuff. So we actually stayed in Australia for a full year at that point, because we just needed to recoup the funds. And my brother started doing some coding work, working remote. And I love Mexican food, but somehow somebody found me and was like, oh yeah, you Brady, you work in New Zealand at the Mexican restaurant. I just opened up four of them. Like, do you want to manage them for me? I'm like, ah. Okay, I guess so. So, I mean, I got a sweet job though. I was managing four Mexican places in Australia, getting paid really well and got all the free food I could get. So that was huge.
Yeah, and during, okay, so during a year of managing Mexican restaurants, were you still YouTubing at that time? Or did you take a break and then we'll pick it back up later?
Yeah, we weren't YouTubing at all at that point. I mean, we didn't really start like really filming and going after it until we left Australia that year. It was the end of 2011, I think. We had a few videos up on YouTube. But during that year, we didn't film our lives. We didn't edit. We didn't do anything until we left.
Do you regret not filming that? Do you wish you had that kind of that year documented like you have the other ones?
Yeah. I mean, not necessarily working and living in Australia, because that was just like we lived in a tiny apartment and just like worked nonstop. So it's not like my favorite time in life. But the times going through like Vanuatu and Solomon's and like diving the Coolidge and stuff, like, you know, we just didn't have the gear back then. We didn't have big underwater housings with crazy cameras, and we didn't have drones. And so if we would have been able to film that back then, it would have been some crazy episodes. But at the same time, we got to experience it in a way that we probably wouldn't have otherwise if we had tons of cameras. We were still doing it just for our own eyes, not necessarily to try and capture everything. So it all worked out as it should, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I totally understand that, because people are like, yeah, I want to see your travel photos. I'm like, I got them on a hard drive piled away somewhere. I mean, didn't really take a lot of photos. I just kind of saw a lot of stuff. And then, I mean, it's mine. Like, it's in my head. It's in my heart. I mean, I've been traveling for 20 years straight, and like, I did not document it. It just wasn't my thing. I think I tried a couple of times. I bought like big SLR cameras, and then I just end up sitting around and not using it. I think if I had have had a YouTube channel, someone to show it to, I probably would have done the extra effort. But I get that. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, I mean, after that, and after we left Australia that second time, it became a real passion for us. It became like, after that year of working, we were like, fuck that. We don't want to do that anymore. Like, if we can make even a little bit of money doing this video thing, like, let's make that.
Yeah. So that's a good lesson, figuring out once again what you don't want to do.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to work for somebody else. I don't want to work in hospitality. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And then after Australia that time, we went up into Indonesia, did tons of diving in Raja Ampat, and then up into the Philippines. And then we were in the Philippines we were supposed to be there for, I think, 3 or 4 weeks maybe. And we were there for 8 months. We just fell in love with the Philippines, cruised around there. At this point, I had a partner on board as well. So it was me and my girlfriend and my brother and his girlfriend. And then we'd have like one or two random people coming and going as we were traveling.
Yeah. And the girls get along. There was no change in dynamic or make it more difficult with a fourth person on.
No, man, it was pretty good. I mean, it's a very low stress environment, you know, like if you get sick of somebody or get annoyed, like we all understood, you know, you just put some headphones on and go take the paddleboard and go to the beach and go for a long hike or go swimming. And I think in order to live on a boat full time, and a lot of people ask like, oh man, if I don't have any sailing experience, how can I become your crew? And it's like, sailing experience is at the bottom of the list. Like the most important thing is, can you live with other people in close quarters and like feel people's energies and be able to understand if somebody's upset or not upset? And can you communicate and take criticisms without really being upset? Like those are the top of the list. The sailing stuff, we can teach you that. Like that's no problem. It's more just, will you have a mental breakdown living in a small space with so many people?
Well, that makes sense, because I've met some people that, I swear to God, drama just follows them everywhere they go. Like, it doesn't matter what the situation is, what's happening, there is going to be something that's dramatic about it that's going to cause problems that you're going to have a big talk. And I think that would just be like toxic on a boat. Like, you just couldn't have something like that.
Yeah, we always refer to it in whatever anybody we talk to is, a boat's like a pressure cooker. So if you have good and everybody loves each other and there's a lot of good energy, it's just going to grow and be incredible. And everyone's going to be like the best friends and family. But if you have a little bit of drama or a little bit of negativity, it's going to pressure up and it's going to turn into a big situation, a big problem.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense perfectly. So, I mean, if we continue down this path of everywhere you went in the world, I don't think we're going to have time to talk about some of the more modern stuff. So, okay. So let's fast forward a couple of years, because although I do want to hear all these stories, and I reckon me and you need to go and drink a bottle of tequila or something and
definitely
shoot the shit and go through everything. But okay, for brevity's sake and for my audience's sake, let's fast forward a little bit. You've done some... Like, if that stuff wasn't wild enough, the stuff you've done in the last couple of years is, like, really wild. Like, I was watching some of your clips and your videos from sailing in the Arctic. Can you talk to me about that? Like, first of all, I guess, like, what was the genesis of this idea? Because that is not the typical type of sailing I think people would expect.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so just to kind of speed up the timeline a bit, we left Asia, we crossed the Indian Ocean. We ended up in Madagascar and then South Africa, and we were in South Africa about to cross to Brazil. And this is, you know, years down the road, and me and my partner had broken up, and I had met a new partner, Alex, who's still my girlfriend now. And she was on board as kind of a videographer, editor, brought an incredible wealth of knowledge of cameras and kind of post-production, and really upped our editing game like a lot that year in Cape Town. And we were crossing to Brazil, and we got an email. We got service when we got to Brazil, and we got an email from some friends of ours in the sailing community that own a company called 59 North, and they do offshore expeditions.
Believe it or not, I've actually heard of them. I swear to God, I've actually heard of that. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So okay, I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
No worries. They do like a full sailing podcast called On the Wind, and they just take people offshore for offshore experiences and people that want to learn how to sail offshore, or it's a bucket list item. They'll be like, we're sailing from the Caribbean to Annapolis. And you know, it's an 8-day trip and people pay to come along and join them. So they do a lot of stuff up in Northern Norway as well, and up high latitude stuff. So they made trips to do some expeditions in the Arctic, and they wrote us and they're like, listen, there's 3 weeks of our timeline that we don't have booked. And we want you guys, if you want, we want to invite, you know, the Delos crew to come up and film it and like share the experience from your perspective behind the cameras instead of just having like normal guests come aboard. And I mean, we didn't even know where it was. He was like Svalbard, and we're like, where the fuck is that? Yes, we're in, whatever. Yeah. Going to the Arctic, polar bears, glaciers, all this stuff. By this point, we've been sailing around for 9 years and basically living in our underwear in constant tropics, right? Which is, it's great. It's incredible, but it's the same thing that people always, the grass is always greener, and you kind of get a little bit jaded with, there's sand on everything. It's hot. Like, you know, all the stuff that you're like, stop complaining. But after a while, you know?
Yeah.
So we were just like, hell yeah. Like the Arctic, we needed something to re ignite like our passion for filmmaking, and that was it. So we planned for a year for this trip. After we said yes, I mean, we had to buy all the foul weather gear. We had to like do tons of research, get permits. We had to get permits for rifles because up in Svalbard, the polar bear population is bigger than the human population. And in the summertime, they get very hungry, so they've been known to attack humans. So if you leave the little village limits, the town limits, you have to carry a rifle with you to scare polar bears away. Like, you just shoot in the air, and hopefully it scares them away. So yeah, all this stuff led up to a three-week trip to the Arctic that we ended up doing. And this was August of 2018 is when we did that trip.
Okay, so the boat stayed where you were, and you flew up and used their boat. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. We left Delos in the Caribbean, in Grenada. We hopped on a flight and flew to their Andy and Mia are the owners we're talking about, and they live on a boat called Isbjorn, which is Swedish for ice bear, actually.
Cool. So I imagine that would be a special type of boat that would be fitted to deal with Arctic climate and ice and stuff. Am I correct in that?
You'd think so, and I thought so before we went too, but no. I mean, it was it's like an older offshore racing boat, cruiser racer. So it's definitely a liveaboard boat, but there's tons of bunks for a lot of people to sleep. Uh-huh. But it's not like a big steel hull or aluminum hull. It's still fiberglass. Still, wow. I mean, they added a heater on board, which definitely was necessary. But it's not what you'd see. It's not what you'd expect to be a full-on, like, high Arctic crazy boat. It's just like a normal sailboat.
Amazing. And then did you guys do any diving up there? Did you do any dry suit diving or anything?
We didn't do any diving. There was a guy, James, that was with us. That's an amazing photographer that we brought along. And he got in the water plenty with his dry suit, but just, like, swimming around and taking photos. We didn't do anything under the surface.
Mm-hmm. And no Wim Hof jumping into cold water type of thing?
We did that. It was terrible.
Did you really?
Yeah. Yeah, we got into the water right in front of a glacier at 80 degrees north. And that's the name of the series, is 80 degrees north, sailing on top of the world. And yeah, jumping in the water up at that latitude is just, I mean, it feels like...
Can you even describe something like what would... I'm from southwestern Ontario. I've been in cold water. But I've never been in anything like that, I'm very sure.
Yeah, you have to go watch the documentary, Our Reactions Say Enough. It's like, it's just, you know, pins and needles, your body goes numb. It's intense, man. It takes your breath away. And I could see how people can have a quick panic attack and then maybe have hypothermia pretty fast. So you just have to, Andy loves it. The guy, the captain of the boat, he was in the water on his back, like, just breathe, relax. And we're like, fuck you. But it was a great experience jumping in the water there. And you kind of have to do it. It's kind of a rite of passage when you're up at that altitude.
For sure, for sure.
I keep saying altitude at that latitude.
So talk to me a little bit, a bit more about where the location was. Because I lived in the Arctic for 366 days. I was in the Baffin Islands in Iqaluit, right next to Greenland. So like I went to Greenland, I went to Nuuk and stuff. But were you more in the Scandinavian side? Did you stay over there or did you sail a lot in the area?
We just stayed in the group of the archipelago of Svalbard. So it's like, if you go up to the northwest tip of Norway, and then you go just northwest of there. Yeah, it's hard to see the map, but it's 600 miles from the North Pole, and it's just a small island. So we just stayed around that island or that group of islands for 3 weeks straight. So again, it's kind of, yeah, northeast of Greenland and Iceland, a little bit higher up into the Arctic Circle.
Beautiful. So then talk to me about the documentary. So you guys decided you were going up there specifically to film what it is like for sailing there. Talk to us a little bit about the documentary and then the monetization of it, because I think this kind of circles back to our conversation earlier about how you funded your trips. And this is a really interesting way you've done it. I'm not going to spoil the surprise, but I mean, I've never seen anyone do this type of monetization.
Yeah. So when we first said yes to this trip, we knew we wanted to do something different, because in the YouTube world, you can only push yourself so much as videographers and editors and filmmakers, because there's always that Friday deadline. If you're putting a video out once a week, like you have to release it. Whereas this, we were like, you know what, we're going to go up there and we're going to film it in a very cinematic way. We're going to do like sit down interviews. We're going to really take the extra time. And then we're going to choose whether we want to put it on YouTube as our normal series of episodes or do something bigger with it later, depending on how the footage came out. So after the 3 weeks of filming, my girlfriend and I sat down and we looked at the footage and we were like, oh yeah, this is definitely way bigger than just the normal Friday release YouTube channel. So we decided to really take the extra effort and start editing it into we wanted to do like a 3-part series, each part like 45 minutes long, something like that. And of course, at the same time, we were back on Delos and we were still running the YouTube channel and traveling and sailing. So it got put on the back burner a lot. So it wasn't full-time editing, but it took us about 2 years to complete the project.
Holy moly. And did you guys do all the editing between like amongst yourselves, or did you need to bring in professional help for it?
No, we did it all. Me and my girlfriend did most of the editing, and there's another guy, Kirill. He's a South African guy that sailed with us. He does tons of editing as well for us. And he did a huge chunk of it. Alex, my girlfriend, did a huge chunk of it, and I did a huge chunk of it, all the way from editing to color grading to finding the person to do the narration, audio engineering, everything. We did all in-house.
Cool. Well,
that's why it took 2 years.
Yeah, I get that. So, I mean, like I said, I was on the page, and actually, straight off the bat, what is the page if people want to learn more about this, if they want to find out and maybe check out your work? What is that page right now?
80NorthSeries.com.
80NorthSeries.com. I went on that and I watched the trailer and I was like, wow, this looks like, you know, BBC Planet Earth, you know, style of David Attenborough type of documentary. And I'm like, this is not what I was expecting. I have to be honest. I mean, I was thinking YouTube. I had seen you guys' YouTube channel probably like 6 months or a year ago. And then when we got introduced, I was like, yeah, I know their work. And it was like, I knew a little bit about sailing, not very much, but I mean a little bit. And I was kind of thinking, oh, they did a documentary. I was expecting that, but with snow, you know?
Right.
And then I saw the trailer and I was like, holy moly, like this is another level.
It's a bit different, huh?
It's very different in a good way, in an absolutely good way. I'm trying to be very complimentary here. I'm not sure if that's
coming through. No, but I really appreciate it. It means a lot. Yeah, I mean, like people in the sailing industry have described it as being like YouTube meets Jacques Cousteau meets Discovery Channel, like something like that. Like it still has like our personality and our vlogging kind of style, but it also has a very cinematic and well thought out shots and interviews and incredible footage. So, and the reason we wanted to do that is we wanted to really separate something from Delos as well, where if you'd never heard of Delos or never heard of sailing around the world, whatever, you could still watch this mini series and understand who we were and what was going on. That was a huge part of it, is that it could appeal to everybody. So once we started finishing it, then we were looking to what to do with this, right? You're like, okay, well, the traditional routes of Netflix or Hulu or Amazon Prime or Discovery Channel, all these things. And when we started going down that route and I started talking to all the executives and the people that take on these new projects, a lot of the feedback was basically like, where's the drama? Like, you know, we need to change this music here, or this is too long, or that's not going to fit. It was just a lot of like, change a bunch of things, and they never really gave us a formal offer. But from what I talked to of friends that have got documentaries bought by them, it wouldn't have been, I mean, maybe it would have covered our production budget. It was so low that it was just like, yeah, we just sat back and we're like, okay, well, what do we do? How do we release this in a different way?
So you had a finished product completely done. You showed it to them and this was kind of their response.
Yep. Yeah, they're like, you know, it needs a little bit higher risks. And I'm like, we're sailing in the Arctic and we have to have rifles because of polar bears. And there's like glaciers crashing and trying to like crash the boat with ice is going to crash the boat and stuff. And but it's the
but there was
same
no
thing
fights
with,
on board. You guys all got along.
Yeah, that's,
it's kind
that's
of
exactly
like what we were talking about before about the pressure cooker. And maybe they want that type of drama because they think that that's what sells. But actually, that's the worst thing that could happen. I mean, you don't want that kind of stuff. So
Yeah, I was like, yeah, some of the guys, I was like, oh, you mean like you like the steaks that are in your baking show that's on Netflix right now? Like, you know, I was just like, oh, are the steaks in that? But they just want, exactly, they want people to argue. They wanted the crew to not get along as well as we did. And I'm like, well, I don't have that footage because it didn't happen. Like, we got along really well. This is 100% truth of what happened. So we were like, you know what? We're just going to release it ourselves. We're just going to, and this idea of doing we released it in a pay what's fair model was just kind of Radiohead back in the day released an album. Remember the days of like Napster and LimeWire and Kazaa, and everybody was pirating music. So Radiohead came out and was like, you know what? Everybody's going to download our shit for free. Why don't we just have everybody download it from our website and just ask them to pay what they think is fair after listening to the album.
That was Hail to the Thief, I think they did that for. I think it was. I sat and talked with Tom York and his wife and his two kids in first class on a flight one day.
Oh, cool.
And I was like, this was unbelievable. They were like super, super cool. They were going to the Maldives on vacation. Sorry, yeah. Side note there, that just memory just popped That's in awesome. My mind. Yeah.
No, it's cool. I mean, that concept was huge. It was one of the most successful albums ever because of that. Because people, when they were given the choice to pay whatever they wanted, often paid more than what they would have thought would be fair if it was a set price.
And so did you find that was the same? Did you get that same type of result as the model did in the past?
Well, because we've never charged anybody for anything. So we don't know. It was fully, and like nobody's ever done this in the sailing world. And there's another YouTube channel called Yes Theory, where the guys did it for one of their documentaries. They did a pay what's fair thing. And they said it turned out incredibly well. So we were like, what do we have to lose? You know, we just need to put it in front of people and show them the trailer, show them how much work we put into it, and then have them pay what they think is fair. And yeah, I mean, it's been a wild ride, that's for sure. Like, a lot less people have paid than I thought, but they're paying more on average.
Okay. Can you break down those numbers for us, or is that kind of?
Yeah, for sure. So I can tell you that the production budget, which normally on a documentary like this, from friends of ours and researching what other documentaries cost, would be around $150,000 to $200,000. Like, that's like a normal production budget. Ours was right around $80,000.
Cool.
Something wow. like that.
And, probably because you did a lot of the work yourself.
Did everything
in
ourselves.
House.
So a lot of that work and time was like our time, my time that I didn't write down hourly for, that somebody else, if we would outsource it, would have charged us $80 an hour to do. So that's why the price is quite low. And then so far about 10,000 people have watched, and the average cost is about 15, or the average price people pay is about $15. So it's about 150 grand. But in the scheme of things, when you talk about the money invested and 2 years of work and four people, and, you know, it works out to like maybe making $10,000 a year. So it's not like, yeah, it's not like a lucrative thing by any means. Didn't make us rich, but at least we were able to make our investment back, which is huge, and prove that it worked. And it's still out there. So like,
well, that was going to be
still
my point.
Watching it.
Exactly, and I encourage my listeners to go out there and check it out. I mean, absolutely, you guys shouldn't. I think that I'm going to go and do that tonight. I mean, if I've got free time tonight, I think this is what I'm going to do. Probably should have done it before the interview, but that's all right. Never mind.
That's all right. No, it's better. It's great. And yeah, so it's a four-part series. Each part is about 30 minutes long. So you can binge it if you want, do the full 2 hours, or you can watch one at a time. And yeah, you go to adrseries.com, watch the trailer, type in what you think is fair to pay for it. Four-part series, 2 years of crazy hard work, and then enjoy. And it's just available.
Sweet. Well, I would imagine that because you have such a big following on YouTube, and I do believe in reciprocity, I think that people are going to be appreciative of all the hard work you guys have done over the last 10 years of sailing and documenting and trying to help people. That, like, I think with a lot of your videos, people are really learning something. This is like a university course, a master class in how to sail and how to do these things and how to live overseas on a boat. I mean, I think that you would get a lot of reciprocity. A lot of people would want to support you and really give back. They're not going to try to nickel and dime you. That would be my expectation.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're 100% right. I mean, our kind of audience and the Delos tribe, what we call them, is just, yeah, super incredible like that when it comes to that sort of thing. They understand how much work is involved in what we've done over the years, and that the, all the YouTube is obviously for free, and it continues, it'll be for free forever. And then the amount of work that goes into the series, 99.9% of the people are like, yes, we love it. We're so stoked. We're happy to contribute. There's that 0.1% that's like, you guys sold out. I can't believe you're charging us for stuff. Like, unfollow. You're like, okay, bye. I don't care, man. I don't really care. Like, I hope you're okay. but overall, it's been, yeah, received really well. And tons of magazine articles. And it's just in the whole sailing community, it's been really received amazing.
Awesome. So what's next on the horizon? More documentaries, more pay-as-you-go documentaries? I mean, you're not talking to me from the boat right now, so what's right. happening there? I mean, talk to me about the yeah. changes.
Yeah, so Alex and I, my girlfriend and I, we left Delos about a year ago, and we live in Lake Tahoe now in California. We came here for the season because, like, that whole being jaded thing, living on the boat, I was like, I need a freaking break from living on this boat and filming my everyday life. So we came up to the mountains to snowboard, and then COVID hit. So it's like, well, might as well just stick around for a little bit. And in that time, we've kind of, yeah, put some roots down. We started a sailing school here. So we're not full-time on Delos anymore, but my brother, his wife, and their daughter are on board, and they're still making, it's like a family sailing channel now, which is really cool. And they're still making weekly episodes. They're putting them out about raising a little girl on the boat. And Alex and I, yeah, we started our sailing school in Lake Tahoe, where anybody around the world can come and learn the basics of sailing all the way up to crossing oceans, like offshore passages, really intense sailing. And yeah, we're still making films. Just yesterday, Alex and I were out filming dog mushing, and we're going to make a short film on like the history of dog sledding and how cool it is just to be out in the forest with dogs. And yeah, just making films out of a passion now instead of a necessity every Friday to make money, I guess. We're trying to start the sailing school to have a financial game and then, you know, do the passion stuff for a passion again.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That makes sense. So do you think that you will do another around the world trip, maybe on a boat with just you and the girlfriend? Or do you 100%. Think that maybe that... part of your life is finished?
100%. Just the other day, we were looking at a boat down in Sausalito. It's a 42-foot 1980 passport, and it's an ocean-going crossing boat that's definitely going to be part of our fleet. And we're going to use that to sail down to Mexico, across the Pacific, and also to bring people on board to teach them how to provision, how to check weather, how to properly live on a boat and sail the world if they want to do it.
Sounds amazing. Brady, awesome conversation. Super, super interesting. I'm really stoked for you. Man, you've done some awesome stuff. If my listeners want to find out more about what you do, if they want to check out the channel, if they want to check out the documentary, please give them that link. Where can my people find you? Where can they reach out to you?
Yeah, if you just search SV Delos on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, that's kind of, you'll find over 400 episodes of us sailing and traveling the world there. That's gone from me being a 20-year-old to all the way up to like 33. So like you can see me growing up through the episodes. And of course, my brother now has a baby on board. So it's a really cool channel to follow from the beginning. For us specifically for the sailing school, you can check out Cruisers Academy on both on YouTube. We have a YouTube channel and on Instagram. And cruisersacademy.com. And then, of course, the documentary is 80NorthSeries.com. And you should go watch that right now.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And we'll talk soon. Okay, Brady?
Thanks, man.
Thank you so much for listening to today's interview. Talk soon.
This episode may be over, but your journey to greatness continues by visiting our webpage and signing up for our newsletter. For convenient access to new episodes, show notes, and other crucial resources, visit expatmoneyshow.com. We look forward to you joining us on the next episode of the Expat Money Show. Safe travels.
Every month, we offer exciting new webinars for our community. Topics include how to use retirement accounts to buy real estate overseas, how to get a second passport in Latin America, why you should sell your stock portfolio and move your money offshore, how to buy beachfront rental properties in Brazil for less than $100,000 or apartments in Paraguay for less than $60,000. If you want to join us for free for these presentations with live Q&A, insider secrets, and exclusive opportunities with my professional network of experts, then go to expatmoney.com/webinars. That's expatmoney.com/webinars to register for free upcoming presentations. expatmoney.com/webinars.